Welcome, everyone, to a regular episode of Podcast Them Softly. This is episode 18, and this is Nick, and of course, I'm joined with Frank. What's going on, buddy?
Hello!
It's a very excited greeting. I know we're both excited to have a regular show today, so, and it's going to be one where it should be a very passionate discussion. We're going to be talking about Tony Scott's Domino, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. Tony Scott was easily one of my favorite filmmakers of all time, somebody that I just constantly look forward to. I can't express how much, how sad I am that he's no longer with us and making movies anymore, which is a huge bummer. But tonight we'll get a chance to talk about our top five Tony Scott films. We're going to talk about Domino, and we're also going to get into top five performances from Mickey Rourke, who features very prominently in Domino. So I'll have Frank start it off on the conversation, because while I've seen Domino about 10,000 times at this point, including five times in the theater, this was a movie that, Frank, you did not see in the theater and recently saw it for an earlier podcast when we discussed the top five performances of Keira Knightley, who I'm a huge fan of, and I told you that there'd be no way we could do a list without having you see Domino, of course. So why don't you talk to me about your thoughts on the film, and we'll go from there.
Yeah. I just want to take the mic over real quick before you run away with it, talking about Domino, because I know how much you love this film. And you're right. I never saw it in theaters. I tried to watch it before I even met you, and it was just too much for me at that time. But this movie is too much, and I mean that's what it's supposed to be, and it achieves that rather well. But I have seen the movie four times in my life, you've probably seen Domino as many times as I've seen Manhunter.
Yeah, something.
Although,
I mean.
Maybe not as many times as I've seen Manhunter, but I get it. I mean, I get that it's like a seminal film for you, and it's one of your favesies. What originally draws me to Domino is the factual story of it, of how she's Lawrence Harvey's kid, and I think that's fascinating. I think the story of it's fascinating, that she's Lawrence Harvey's daughter and she becomes a bounty hunter. I mean, I think most people who listen know who Lawrence Harvey is, and if you don't, Lawrence Harvey was an actor. He was most well known for being Raymond Shaw in the original Manchurian Candidate, and he was also in John Wayne's The Alamo. But I think right there, that film should pique most people's interest as, wow, this is going to be an interesting story. But you have if you've never seen this movie, nothing can prepare you for the asinine roller coaster that this film takes you on. I mean, this film is so hard hitting and in your face. I can't think of too many films that are as in your face as Domino, and it's not going to be for everybody. And I think that the reception of the film clearly signifies that.
Yeah,
but
hostile.
I mean, it's hostile. I mean, people hate this movie, and it's like, well, whatever, fuck them. The movie's not for them. But this film is. I mean, I like Tony Scott a lot. I don't love Tony Scott as much as you do, but I still like Tony Scott a lot. And I view Domino now as, it's hard to peg it. I don't want to say it's his most personal film. I don't necessarily think that's the way of saying it, but I certainly think it's a seminal film, and probably out of all the films that Tony Scott has made, I think this is the signature Tony Scott film. This film feels like the film that, like, I want to make this. I'm going to do whatever I want to do to this movie, and this is going to be my child. Like, out of all my children that I've had, this is my most important one. And, I mean, don't you think so? Do you agree with me on that?
Absolutely. And just like a little context, because I would be crazy not to have my own little storytelling moment. I did have a chance for anyone. We've mentioned it on other podcasts because it's come up, but I had the very fortunate experience to intern for Tony Scott when he was just finishing Spy Game, and Domino and Man on Fire were both being developed simultaneously. So for the 6 months that I was an intern at Totem Productions, which was his personal office outside of Scott Free, and you know the time that he would spend over at RSA at Ridley Scott Associates, I saw Domino getting built from the ground up for those 6 months. The story meetings, you know, Steve Brancic and Richard Kelly and Tony flipping out about the real Domino Harvey and, you know, wanting to make this crazy movie. And I had read some early drafts of it, and I couldn't believe where this movie was potentially going to go. And, you know, he ended up doing Man on Fire first, which was also like taking up a lot of his time. To remember him being, it was crazy being in his orbit, watching him edit Spy Game, develop Man on Fire and Domino. It was like just totally crazy. And you hit it right on the head. Domino, from what I've always could tell, and from what I distilled from knowing him a little bit and knowing some people in his, you know, in his world, it was definitely his most personal film. It was the movie that he sort of had been leading up to his whole career. It was independently financed. You know, Samuel Hadida put up the money for it. I think there were some other people as well, but I know Hadida put up most of, if not the whole budget. It was purchased by New Line after the fact, if I'm not mistaken. So it was really a chance for Tony Scott to just fire on all, you know, aesthetic cylinders. Nobody really telling him what to do. No one saying no. For a lot of people, as you said, critically, the movie was just completely shit on. No one wanted to give it a chance. Everyone called it style over substance, which couldn't be further from the truth if you actually sat down and watched the movie, because there's plenty going on a narrative level and a character level. And as always with every Tony Scott movie, no matter how shiny or slick or cool it looked, there was always a very, very strong heart beating at the middle of the story. I mean, every one of his movies was a very heartfelt narrative, no matter how intense or violent or, you know, insane some of the, you know, the plotting or the action sequences would get. But no, this was definitely, you know, as I've said it in my written pieces, it's the toniest Tony Scott movie ever made. I mean, it's all the Tony Scott you could ever want in a movie. It was just him completely going wild and, you know, building on the style that he had started in the 80s with Bruckheimer, that really, you know, slick and gritty, you know, approach to action films, which then started to get more experimental, you know, when he did Man on Fire. And he did a really cool short film for Amazon called Agent Orange. And when you watch that, if you've ever seen it, you can see, I believe Daniel Mindel also shot Agent Orange. He was a cinematographer on Domino, or maybe it was Paul Cameron. I can't remember either one, but, you can see where the style was progressing. You know, Man on Fire sort of took things to a new realm with the subtitles and the overlapping images and the staccato editing, and Domino really pushed it to the extreme. You know, like you said, there's few movies that feel like Domino. And you're absolutely right. I sort of feel like, you know, Domino is like the bastard child of Natural Born Killers. And, you know, movies like, you know, Wayne Kramer's Running Scared and Michael Davis's Shoot 'Em Up and, you know, Joe Carnahan's Smokin' Aces and Stretch, you know, those movies that are sort of operating at full throttle and are sort of making a comment on genre, on pop culture, you know, at the same time as providing these really insane widescreen action, you know, fantasias, which is pretty much what Domino is. I mean, it's a
widescreen fantasia.
I mean,
I want to interject real quick before you browbeat me down hard. But I disagree with you in a way where I think that this film is more style over substance. And the way I see it, I think it's supposed to be, and I think that's okay, because Domino is the holy grail of Tony Scott's style.
Yeah.
And I think that, along with what you were saying, I think this is the film where he just completely put everything he's ever wanted to do visually into a film and just hit it hard.
Absolutely. And the visuals in Domino, the visuals and his style certainly was his primary focus. There's no question about it. I mean, he was, you know, he went out of his mind. I mean, I completely agree. I just think that there's more story and more character and more interesting things going on a narrative level than people gave it credit for being. I mean, if you really read some of the reviews, there are people that just sat there and either checked out for 2 hours mentally and just didn't try to follow the plot, which, you know, is exciting and has some really cool stuff in it, and, you know, is fairly unpredictable for the most part. But I completely agree with you. The movie is the apex of Tony Scott's style and his sensibility. And certainly, you know, at that time. And what's interesting to see is when the film came out and it bombed in theaters and critics hated it. What was his follow-up movie? It was a Bruckheimer film, was Deja Vu, which, you know, when you look at it, entertaining film, in my opinion, kind of underrated, better than people gave it credit for being. But that movie was sort of like his response to the failure of Domino, where Deja Vu is a very expressionistic looking piece of work. It's not your traditional Bruckheimer movie. It feels one of, like, really one of the most artistic Bruckheimer movies ever made. But he went back to that high concept well, which he knew so well and felt comfortable in, which I, you know, I've always found very interesting. But getting back to Domino, totally agree. This was the movie where he just completely flipped out and said, you know, someone's given me money and I don't have to listen to any studio guy telling me what to do. And, you know, he always had a fair amount of control, I'm willing to imagine, on most of his movies. And, you know, there probably weren't too many times he was told no, if you know what I mean. But this one really, truly feels like, you know, it really feels like someone just set him loose and just said, "Hey, Tony, don't worry about anything. We got your back."
Oh yeah, man. And I honestly think that I think this is one of the best casts that Tony Scott had ever pulled together. I mean, dude.
And he always had a great cast, but yes.
Oh, and he's always been phenomenal with casting.
Yeah, just one of
his
talents.
Yeah. Keira Knightley headlines this film, and then the two, I would say, prominent supporters to her are Mickey Rourke as her, you know, quote-unquote mentor. Well, he is her mentor.
He's the boss.
He's her father figure. He's the boss, yeah.
The father figure. And then everything else.
Edgar Ramirez is great. He's great in everything.
Yeah,
but,
terrific.
He's terrific in this.
And one of the first times you really saw him in a prominent role.
Right. And then, I mean, geez, it just trickles down to everybody from, I mean, you get Delroy Lindo, Mina Suvari, Macy Gray, Jacqueline Bisset, Christopher Walken, and then to just put icing on the Tony Scott mega cake that's about to explode as soon as you watch this, you get Monique and Dabney Coleman.
Yeah, dude.
I mean,
dude, and then
Coleman is in a Tony Scott film.
The cast is incredible. And then what I always loved about the script, and you know, I don't remember from the early drafts that I read whose idea. I'd have to assume. I just am assuming it was Richard Kelly because he's probably younger than Steve Baranczyk. But I always loved the addition of Brian Austin Green and Ian Ziering, you know, the 90210 component. This movie takes a turn at the hour mark, roughly, where there's a subplot in this film. But basically, the premise of Domino, because we've been talking about how much we enjoy it. The premise of Domino is that this posh British chick is going to all of a sudden become a down and dirty bounty hunter. She's got really nothing else to do. She comes from a background of family of money. She's kind of a wild child, rebellious, and she gets taken under the wing by Mickey Rourke and Edgar Ramirez to sort of take her on this crash course tour of Los Angeles. And it's a great Los Angeles movie too. The location work is amazing, and it just looks and feels and just all of it just feels very Los Angeles. And basically what occurs is just one thing after another of increasing lunacy. There's an armored car component, a robbery. There's a you mentioned that Monique is in the film, and there's this, the juice of the film is centered on a little girl who's dying and who needs a medical treatment which can't be afforded. So all of these various characters spin in this, it's weird. You almost want to call it, it feels like a companion piece of sorts to True Romance, this tableau of all this, crime and criminals and crazy personalities. You could almost call True Romance and Domino, Tony Scott's Robert Altman movies in the sense that they're sprawling and they're taking place over these big cities with all these characters that are intermingling and sort of finding each other within the narrative. The craziness of the film, sort of stems from all the adventures that, she goes on with them and, doing all these little, these side trips and everything else. And, it really was just one of those films where, the screenplay went in some directions where you're not necessarily thinking that this movie's going to do that. And then it does. And at about an hour into the film, there's a subplot where Christopher Walken's a reality TV producer, and he wants to put a show on for the WB network called Bounty Squad. And it's going to be following them around, Keira Knightley and her group as they go on their, their raids. So the movie sort of takes this interesting self-reflexive spin, and it becomes a comment on reality TV as well as becoming a comment on action films. And it's just so funny. The stuff with Christopher Walken just kills me. I love his whole performance and flipping out about how the ladies changed the font on his promo and he's losing it. And then his interactions with Brian Austin Green. And you get you have the best scene where Mickey Rourke tells Brian Austin Green to shut the fuck up. And it's like one of the greatest moments, like the look on Brian Austin Green's face. Like, they were so game for those cameos, and they knew that they were being sort of, their images and their personalities were being fucked with a bit. But it's just such a wild film. Like, it's overstuffed on purpose. It's really in your face. And like you said, it's not going to work for everybody. It's aggressive. It's one of those movies that's happy to be aggressive.
Oh yeah, without a doubt. And I will say that, I love that this film was made, or I should say that Mickey Rourke was put into this film, because this was around the time of Mickey Rourke's comeback. And I think Mickey Rourke's comeback started before The Wrestler. I think The Wrestler is the pinnacle of his comeback, and it was all downhill after The Wrestler. But
Tony put him in fire the year before.
Oh yeah, I mean, yeah, Man on Fire, Sin City, This Once Upon a Time in Mexico,
2000.
But I mean, we'll get into that when we talk about our top five Mickey Rourke. But for me, this film, it all comes back to the casting for me, and just this array of amazing talent that gets just half these people don't even belong in this movie. Like, the movie's already ridiculous enough as it is with the storyline, and Keira Knightley is just out of fucking control in this. And then, you get, like I've said with Mickey Rourke, you get the hard-nosed boss father figure that's awesome. And then you get Christopher Walken as just the zany reality TV producer that's just doesn't even belong in the world. Like, he just,
ferret on crystal meth, as they call him.
Yeah, exactly. And then I mean, I've said it before, but I mean, dude, Dabney Coleman in this movie is awesome. I mean, he doesn't have a very big part.
No, but he's so good at the end.
But he's so good at the end, and it's just the fact that Dabney Coleman's in this is what makes it just great, man, on so many different levels. I will say that the cinematography, particularly the use of color in this film, is just outrageous. I think you're right with saying the only other film that I think would be like a spiritual cousin or can be relatable to this film would certainly be Natural Born Killers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
This is the only Natural Born Killers-esque film I think I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
Or vice versa. The only Domino-esque film I've seen is Natural Born Killers. And, I mean, you and I have seen a lot of movies. When you put both of us together,
no,
it's not even funny how many movies we've seen, but
and it's true.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I've always felt, I mean, for me, I've always been a fan of Ridley Scott as well. Tony Scott for me was just, he was just always just so, I just was so excited to see his movies. When I would see a trailer, I would know that there'd be this wild and intense sound and fury.
All right, here, I love this, though. I love this about you, because I love Ridley Scott. I mean,
I love
Ridley Scott.
I love him, too.
But can you even explain your affinity for Tony Scott?
You know what it is? There was this sense of, like, there was just this inherently cinematic sense to Tony Scott. Not that other filmmakers aren't, but it was just always whenever I sit down to watch a Tony Scott movie, I just get a sense that this guy was just in love with making movies move really fast and
right.
just really in love with the texture of cinema and how images and sound sort of collide. I grew up on action films, you know. Top Gun for me is like, I've watched that movie a million times. I mean, like, that was like my shit. I was 6 years old when that movie came out, when I was watching it, you know, on videotape when I was 7 and 8. I mean, there was nothing cooler. I mean, honestly, one of the earliest movie memories I have is just seeing the director's credit directed by Tony Scott in the jet engine flame of Top Gun when I was a little kid. And I remember just like not knowing who that was. I don't know what the hell that means, directed by, but it was just so fucking cool. And that was one of the things about Tony Scott's movies that I always loved about them. They were cool. They were just fucking cool. They were rated R. You had movie stars. They looked amazing. He was, you know, again, in his death, he's gotten more critical notoriety and acclaim, and people are turning the page and saying, yeah, he was an auteur, and you could string one movie up after another and you could tell that they were his work. And, you know, I've always felt that he was even more of a signature stylist, a consistent signature stylist than his brother. Not that Ridley Scott doesn't create masterful images, but because he does. But Ridley Scott has adopted a style sort of that fluctuates from genre to genre, whereas Tony pioneered an aesthetic, he modified it, he then went back to the drawing board in the middle of the late end of his career and tried something new. And, you know, with his last couple pictures, Taking of Pelham and Unstoppable and Deja Vu, I always felt that you had this awesome mix of what the studio was looking for in terms of a commercial movie and what Tony was looking for in terms of what he wanted to do as an artist. And, you know, he was a guy for me that could elevate a solid script. And he always had a solid script. I would say that there's probably like two instances maybe where like the script wasn't all that great. You know, and in every instance, he elevated, in my opinion, the material because of his visual sensibility. Movies are a visual form. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to go to the theater. I want to watch something gorgeous. I want to see stories told as visually as possible. So I think that's really what always attracted me to his movies. And, again, just being a kid from the 80s and seeing Cop 2 and Top Gun and Days of Thunder and, you know, even The Hunger. I mean, even something like The Hunger, which I've never been a horror movie guy or a vampire movie guy or anything like that. And that was one I watched when I was younger because it was the guy who directed Top Gun. You know, he had made a vampire movie. So when I was like 10, I had to seek it out.
Right. I think that Ridley Scott and I think Ridley Scott is kind of genreless or more ambiguous with his authorship. I mean, there's no correlation between Blade Runner and The Counselor.
No.
Or Black Rain and
Black Hawk Down. Yeah.
Black Rain and Gladiator or Kingdom of Heaven and Someone to Watch Over Me.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of, he's just like an enigma when he takes on films as to where Tony Scott, you know, you're watching a Tony Scott film.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as soon as the opening scene or as soon as you see the credits, I mean, you know, for a fact. And that's why I think it's so interesting to me that Ridley Scott did Black Rain. I love Black Rain. I mean, I own it. I watched that. I grew up watching that in VHS. My grandma loved it for some reason, so I always watched it with her. It was weird. I mean, I know. My mom would be like, what'd you do with grandma and grandpa? I'd be like, oh, we watched Black Rain.
It was Michael.
My mom would get all pissed off because, like, I was 8 or 10 watching Andy Garcia's head get chopped off with a samurai sword. But anyway, you know, because what's interesting about Black Rain is that's a Tony Scott movie.
Yeah, Black Rain and G.I. Jane and what's the other one? Body of Lies. Those are the three movies I've always felt were Ridley's Tony movies.
Right, and I think that's cool. But, yeah, you know, I mean, Tony Scott, man. You know it's a Tony Scott movie, and that's what's so great about Tony Scott. He has that visceral style, like a Tarantino or a Scorsese, where he has that distinct authorship.
And it's funny that you bring up Scorsese and Tarantino because, you know, those are two of my other, you know, top five. My favorite filmmakers, Tony Scott, Quentin Tarantino, Martin Scorsese, Michael Mann, Oliver Stone, those are the guys that immediately come to mind. Brian De Palma, and all of those names, you know, are guys who just fucking live, breathe, and eat cinema. Like you just know that cinema's in their bones, and they were put here on this earth, you know, to make movies. And not that other filmmakers aren't. And I totally agree with what you're saying about Ridley Scott's interchangeable sense of style. And he's always been a wonderful image maker. I mean, come on, fucking Blade Runner and Alien are two of the greatest movies ever made, and they're going to stand the test of time, longer than most films, you know, ever will. There was just something so, like I've said before, cool and sort of rock and roll about Tony Scott's movies that, you know, I just really responded to. And getting back to the look of the film, I mean, Daniel Mindel was a guy, you know, is a guy who shot multiple movies for Tony Scott. He, you know, worked on it. He did Enemy of the State. He did Spy Game. And I can only imagine what it must have been like for him to sort of see Tony firing on all cylinders when they made Domino and using the various film stocks and the various techniques and the various cameras. And from what I've read, they used multiple types of cameras. I mean, old ones, new ones. I mean, it was like, it must have been like a film school in its own way, you know, for everybody on that set, you know, working in with the various, you know, styles that they were doing. And I think it's just a work of art. I mean, I've said it in print, and I really do feel it. I feel like it's a cubist movie. It's this movie made up. It's this large picture made up of really small fragments. People used to knock Tony Scott because of too much editing, the MTV style editing, whatever. That's just another style to tell your story. If you do it well, you do it well. In my opinion, he did it the best. And that movie just is like, it's like a smorgasbord of wild shit, of color, of sound, of just general craziness.
I
think it's funny your initial comment that you watched it, you tried to get into it one time, you know, previously, and it was just too much, and it was just you know, you just didn't gel with you.
Yeah, I mean, it was I don't remember what I was doing or when I attempted it, but I mean, it was just like, okay, this is way too much for me. Because it was the initial, like, this is Lawrence Harvey's daughter who becomes a bounty hunter, Mickey Rourke's in it, and Christopher Walken's in it, and I just remember, like, starting it, and I was just like, whoa.
Yeah.
Too much. But, I mean, I'm glad I revisited. I mean, I own it now, and I'm glad I've watched it a couple times.
People forget that this movie is essentially being narrated by someone who's, like, coming down from a mushroom trip. So, you know, like,
I know.
I mean, like, that's the other thing too. So, like, why is everything like if you were paying attention from the outset, you know, you would know that not all is right when you see her in that opening with Lucy Liu. And then as the story gradually unfolds, you figure out that when she's recanting that story, she's mere hours coming down from a massive trip. So, you know, events might be crazy. It might be fuzzy. They might be hazy. They might be a little scattered. So I always interpreted that as, you know, an excuse for Tony's craziness, you know, his visual, you know, flourishes throughout the movie. It's a fucking insane movie. I mean, you get Tom Waits out in the desert as this, like, you know, like pseudo mystical, like not a shark.
Oh, yeah. And Tom Waits.
It's this amazing interlude with Tom Waits. You get a great sex scene with one of the only times that Keira Knightley's ever gone nude in a movie. You know, and, you know, leave it to Tony Scott, you know, always a filmmaker in love with good looking people and with shooting bodies in motion and the male and the female form. He was just a filmmaker obsessed with the human body. That much I know, because when I was in his office, I used to see his art books and the shit that he was really interested in. And it was some interesting stuff for sure. Great sex scene in the film. It's hot. It's great. And it comes at a point where the two characters are tripping out simultaneously, which makes it even better. So it's crazy. You have a bruised and bloodied and battered Ian Ziering, like praising like the invisible gods out in the middle of the desert, like, you know, tripping his balls off. It's such a crazy movie, especially. And then you get the crazy ending where you're at the Stratosphere Hotel and that shit's going to explode. You know, it just makes me want to put it on right now. And I just watched it yesterday. You know what I mean? Like,
it's
insane. And I haven't even said anything about the opening credits. The opening credits to Domino are like a movie in and of themselves. They are amazing. I mean, I love the opening credits to that movie.
This movie, to you, is the movie that Jack Horner and Boogie Nights always wanted to make.
Yes. And then you stay for the rest of the picture. Absolutely.
Exactly. I mean, this is that movie. And I think that's what's great. I think that's what's great about cinema in general, man, is we all have these movies.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I knew it. I knew I was – I mean, again, part of it had to have been the sentimental and nostalgic value of, you know, seeing one of your idols up close and personal and, you know, getting a chance to see a movie, you know, at the very early stages and then wondering for, you know, I mean, this was 2001 when I was out there working for him. Yeah, this was the spring of 2001. Yeah, right before 9/11. That's right. Spy Game came out 2 months after 9/11, which is just crazy to think about that they even got a chance to release that movie given the subject matter. But,
right.
But yeah, no, it was one of those things where I thought about it for years after, what is Domino going to be like? And, you know, it just grabbed my attention the moment when I saw it. And again, I saw it 5 times in the theater. That was back in my days of living in LA where anything I remotely enjoyed, I saw it twice. And then if I really liked it, I saw it 3 times. And if I, you know, had nothing to do on Sunday, which I typically didn't, I would see it for the 4th time. Miami Vice and Domino and, you know, the New World. Those were my like three massive obsessions during my LA, you know, experience and going to repeatedly and seeing over and over again. But might be a good time to probably segue into our top five favorite Tony Scott movies.
Yeah.
Do our little.
Okay, you want to go with Tony Scott first?
Yeah, or you want to do Mickey Rourke? Do Mickey Rourke.
No, just do Tony Scott. Just you go ahead with Tony Scott. You're already on a roll. I don't want to interrupt you.
Well, I don't think that it's going to be any secret with what number one is going to be for me. But
no, I don't think so either.
We'll start at number five. Number five is going to be Man on Fire. Man on Fire is another signature Tony Scott movie for me. Another multiple theater trip for me. And a movie really that just sort of got to the heart of Tony as a filmmaker. A great idea, a great cast, an experimental and exciting sense of style, you know, conventions that people are familiar with, the revenge movie, you know, knowing the satisfaction that can come with those type of stories when done right, and getting just a fantastic performance from Denzel Washington, not to mention a really, really solid performance from Dakota Fanning, just really, you know, just it's a compelling movie for multiple reasons. And it was one of those movies, I think, that, again, is just a signature Tony movie. So that's going to be number five for me. And this is just impossible. And I didn't do any ties. So you can't yell at me for ties, which was nearly
impossible. Did one.
I didn't do any ties. I had to play it. You know, I had so many runners up. It's a joke, you know. But number four for me is going to be Enemy of the State. I think that it is just an awesome, awesome Hollywood action thriller. It was prescient in ways that predicted the Patriot Act and predicted where we were going with national security. It was sort of an unofficial sequel to The Conversation. I was just gonna say that. Have Gene Hackman essentially playing the same character. You have
Harry Call.
Yep, you know, Brill in this movie, and just a fantastic cast up and down. Will Smith, when he was, you know, the young Will Smith, hot off of Fresh Prince, his first adult leading role. And you know, I was 18 when that movie came out, you know, in the theater. It was just, for me, it was just like huge. And I watch it once a year. The Daniel Mindel cinematography is amazing. The, you know, Harry Gregson Williams, who did the music, multiple scores for Tony Scott, including Domino. I just feel it works on every level. It's entertaining. It's smart. It's got great style. So that for me is number four. It was tough between Enemy of the State and Spy Game, but I went with Enemy of the State. But I do love Spy Game a lot. Number three for me is True Romance, and what I consider to be his mid-career masterpiece. You know, working with the Quentin Tarantino screenplay, which we all know he famously changed the ending to, which Tarantino, of course, at the beginning wasn't a fan of, but then realized he was wrong and it was Tony Scott. So just shut the fuck up for once in your life. And, you know, he'll even admit to that as much. but I love True Romance. I think it's a fabulous concoction of great dialogue. Again, an obscenely stacked cast. I mean, just Tony Scott was a guy who loved his actors, you know, and again, just didn't get the credit that he deserved for pulling great performances out of people. True Romance is just it's a master's class of supporting actor brilliance. Everybody comes in and nails their individual scene or scenes, and it's funny, it's sexy, it's violent, it's all the things that you'd expect from a Tony Scott movie, but then it's taken to a sort of a different, you know, degree, because it's, you know, that early Tarantino. So number two for me, no question about it, Top Gun. Just an iconic film, one of the most iconic Hollywood action films ever made, a movie that really defined a decade. It may not be the greatest movie ever made, I don't care. It is obscenely quotable. It's ridiculously rewatchable. I couldn't even tell you how many times I've seen Top Gun. I could willing to bet that's probably a movie that almost every American has seen at one point in their life. And it's just classic Tom Cruise, Val Kilmer. I mean, I could just go on and on. Top Gun for me is just a classic of cinema. And number one, without question or hesitation, Domino. you know, just the,
yeah, I didn't know what your number one was going to be.
No. I just, again, as you said, the movie that he was working his way up to, and just in my opinion, a celebration of everything that he loved. And, you know, on this list, I don't have Revenge, his theatrical cut, or the director's cut, the much debated director's cut, Spy Game, Crimson Tide, I don't have on the list. Just a fantastic, submarine thriller there. I mean, there's so...
Yeah, Crimson Tide's great. That's not on my list either. Yeah, spoiler alert.
Yeah, and Crimson Tide is so awesome. It's like, how does that not make your top five? It's because Tony Scott made fucking awesome movies. I mean, even something like The Fan, which, I've always felt was like this, like, really odd entry in Tony Scott's career. Just like this, the one, like... thriller, if you will, or like this strange, sort of entry on his otherwise action oriented career. That movie was elevated because of his sense of style. But what's your top five?
All right, I cheated with my number five. I did a tie because one of them couldn't be a standalone and it needed to be on the list somewhere. But my number five is The Fan, which I've always loved.
Yeah, I love it too.
It's not the best movie he ever made, but it's so good, man.
It's dark.
And it's so rewatchable, and De Niro is just so insanely great in that, and so fucking, like, pulling like a Max Cady, but almost worse than Max Cady in a way. Because at least, like, Max Cady had, like, a mission, and
let me just tell you one thing about The Fan. He did The Fan because of De Niro. That was why. They told me that.
That's awesome.
They did it. They told me at the office. My first day, they said, do not bring up The Fan. For people that don't know The Fan, The Fan bombed, was not well received. Tony was not very happy with the final cut from everything that I was told. But he specifically did the movie because he really, really wanted to work with De Niro. So get back.
That's awesome. So anyway, and then my other number five is Beat the Devil, the BMW Films short film with Clive Owen picking up James Brown, and James Brown made a deal with the devil for a life of fame and prosperity, and in order to keep on doing what he's going to do, they have to beat the devil in a race down the strip of Vegas. And of course, the devil is played by Gary Oldman, and the devil's driver is Danny Trejo. I just supremely suggest people seek out watching the BMW films that got released with Clive Owen. They are incredible films, short films, and it's probably the most brilliant advertising I've ever seen, because BMW just wanted to sell cars. But they just have little short films where Clive Owen, the driver, has to drive somebody somewhere or get out of a jam while driving a BMW. I mean,
yeah,
you get Guy Ritchie doing one, Frankenheimer, John Woo, Joe Carnahan, Tony Scott. I mean, I'm sure I'm missing a director or two, but there's probably like seven or eight of them, and it's available on DVD.
It's amazing.
I don't know. It's great. I own the DVD. I highly suggest. That's what made me want Clive Owen to be James Bond.
Absolutely.
I'm more than happy with Daniel Craig as James Bond, but I thought that Clive Owen would have been a perfect Bond. But anyway, my number four is Deja Vu.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like this film's an unpopular film of Tony Scott's canon, but it's a ridiculous film. I just remember like seeing the trailers for it and being like, oh God, this just doesn't appeal to me. I don't know how this is going to work. But I mean, I saw it one day. I just remember I was at Columbia and I think it was on a movie channel, and I watched it and I was like, holy shit. Like, this movie's good. And it's like it pulls on you emotionally, and it's very good thematically. And I mean, Val Kilmer's in it. Jim Caviezel's great. Obviously Denzel Washington's good. It's just been a film that I've always watched of his anytime I see it on. And it's just been a film I always kind of want to go back and revisit every year or so. I enjoy it. It's a very sweet film. It's got a lot of heart in it, as you know, outlandish as the whole premise of the film is. It works, and it works well.
It's got a beating heart. It's got a very romantic middle, and absolutely right. It got overshadowed when it came out by Casino Royale, It was released like the same weekend or a week after, and it only did like 70 million domestic. Deja Vu looks, dude, the scenes inside of the fucking tech rooms in Deja Vu, they are amazing. The production design is exquisite. I mean, it's like, are you kidding? I think it's a really fun movie. I'm glad to see it in your top five.
Well, you're not going to like my top five after I'm done with it, but thank you, though, so far. My number three is Man on Fire. Man on Fire was a film that I didn't really care for when I first saw it, and then it just kind of grew on me each time after that. It's just, you know, it's probably Denzel's best performance, sans glory in Malcolm X.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's just fantastic in it, and it was kind of at a point in my life where I was kind of tired of Denzel Washington and just seeing him in the action. It was like post Training Day. Am I correct in saying this?
Yes.
Yeah, it was like post Training Day, and you know, when like Training Day came out and he won the Oscar, I was kind of underwhelmed by Training Day. I'm not anymore. I think fucking Training Day is a stroke of genius, and he's very good in that, but it was just kind of a time where I was like kind of like lukewarm with Denzel, but the times are a changing with that, obviously. I think Man on Fire is Tony Scott's epic.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just so obsessed with it frame by frame each time I watch it now. And I will say I've never seen the original, but I really do want to see it because I love Scott Glenn.
It's cool. I mean, it's totally different. Yeah. I actually saw it in Tony Scott's office, which was a trip.
That's awesome.
Yeah, on a video cassette. I was really curious to see it, and it was floating around. So one day a couple of us watched it, and you know, you could see why Tony wanted to take the material, because while it was solid, you know, I believe it was made for TV or something.
I think it was made theatrically, but it got released on TV.
Yeah,
or it was like made to be a feature, but it got released on television.
Yeah.
I remember like some movie channel had it on one time, and I don't know if it was like when I had, but I just didn't get a chance to see it. I remember seeing the opening scene and just being like, whoa, this is different.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I got to see it now. I'm sure I'd enjoy it. I mean, it's got that nice little cast of Scott Glenn and Danny Aiello and Joe Pesci. So I do want to seek that out. But, I mean, Man on Fire is Man on Fire is Man on Fire. And that's Tony Scott's movie. So that's my number three. My number two is Top Gun. And, I mean, bottom line, when it comes to Top Gun, that can be as big of, you know, that can be the biggest propaganda film when it comes to nationalism or, you know, the industrialization of the defense in the 80s or just like, you know, chest beating Reagan and anything you want to say about it's completely true.
Yeah, yeah.
When it comes to that. But I mean,
proudly
Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ, man. What it comes down to is if you don't love Top Gun, you're not American.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
I mean, that's all it boils down to. It's just, yeah, and it's just, Jesus, man. You get Kenny Loggins, Highway to the Danger Zone, and Tom Cruise on a crotch rocket. If that movie, if Tom Cruise was never in a jet and you never saw a jet fly in that film, it would still be the most American movie that's ever been made.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just, it's so good. And you know, what's funny is I've seen or I've heard and read so many Matthew Modine interviews where he said he turned down Top Gun because of like what it represents. And it's like, yeah, I get it. I'm like, way to stick to your guns. But it's like, dude, come on. I mean, it's fucking, this is Top Gun we're talking about here.
Yeah.
I mean, Top Gun, I'm so proud to own that movie. I mean, I've owned that movie on VHS to DVD to Blu-ray to the Tom Cruise Blu-ray set. And I almost bought the 3D Blu-ray of it because I thought one day I'd get a 3D TV, but I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. But, yeah, I mean, Top Gun is quintessential 80s, is quintessential Tony Scott, and it's quintessential
action. Jerry Bruckheimer, Don Simpson, fucking A.
It's quintessential American cinema. is what that film is. So, all right. So my number one, is, and I'm sorry I didn't put Domino on my list, but my number one is True Romance.
Oh yeah, which I honestly feel is probably most people's number one for Tony Scott.
And True Romance and is a double-edged sword because True Romance is a Tarantino film that Tarantino didn't direct. I mean, it's in the Tarantino box set.
Yeah.
And I think most people who are hardcore Tarantino fanboys, myself included, consider that a Tarantino film. But, on the other hand, I mean, what gets any better than Tony Scott directing a Tarantino screenplay
nothing.
With that cast?
No,
I mean,
nothing.
Dude. I mean, that movie is hardcore. That movie feels like a Tarantino movie and feels like a Tony Scott movie. That's what's so brilliant about it. It's Tarantino's script. It's all the zany characters and outlandish characters and the names and the references to Sonny Chiba and the Street Fighter Samurai movies and, you know, the whole coming home in a body bag thing. I mean, that thing is just like Tarantino everywhere. But, I mean, it's done by Tony Scott. And it's, geez, man, it's phenomenal. And not even to mention that cast. And, I mean, you know, I've read all the stuff where Tarantino wanted, or he wrote the part that Walken played specifically for Robert Forster. And Robert Forster auditioned for it and didn't get it. But, I mean, dude, no one could play that part but Christopher Walken. When I first saw that movie on VHS, I was obsessed with it. And my poor dad, man, we rented that movie and, like, we watched it, and I was just, all I would do is talk to my dad about that movie. And my dad, like, finally was like, all right, I get it. True Romance is awesome. But, I mean, I was so obsessed with that Christopher Walken, that's one of the best things Christopher Walken's ever done.
Yep.
Not to mention that scene where he's paired up with Dennis Hopper.
Yeah.
It's like, jeez. It's like, way to get two titans together for probably one of the most memorable scenes, not to mention James Gandolfini and pretty much a dialogue-free character, but he's a gigantic presence in the movie. I mean,
the fight.
That film. And then the dude from Perfect Strangers, Bronson Pinchot, or whatever his name is, it's like, oh, God.
Yeah, I know.
Dude, and I mean, holy God. When I thought I was going to be the next Tarantino screenwriter, or when I thought I was going to be the next, like, big Tarantino, when I was in film school, and I was writing all these screenplays that were just going to be, like, the next Pulp Fiction that are probably on a hard drive in a landfill somewhere. I don't even have them anymore. But, or that computer. Anyway, I was obsessed with the Val Kilmer as Elvis mentor film, and I thought that was one of the most ingenious plot devices that has ever been used in film, and the fact that Tony Scott never shows you his face makes it even better.
Yep.
Dude. All right, anyway, let's move on to our Mickey Rourke, because I could keep talking about True Romance forever.
It's awesome.
But anyway, okay, I'll start then with the Mickey Rourke. How's that sound to you?
That sounds
baby girl. Okay. I can't believe I just called you baby girl on the podcast. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, everybody who has to hear that. Okay. Anyway, all right, my top five, Mickey Rourke. This is hard. I love Mickey Rourke, man. I know the guy.
Yeah, you do.
I know the guy's made a lot of mistakes, and he's fucked his career up more times than most people have ever. But, all right, my number five is a tie. It's The Pledge. His small role in Sean Penn's film, which I think that film is phenomenal.
It is.
I mean, anybody who hasn't seen The Pledge with Jack Nicholson, directed by Sean Penn, please seek it out
and watch it
because
I'm due a revisit soon.
Because I mean, Jack Nicholson's great in it, but what makes that film great is not only the story and Sean Penn's excellent direction, but also the film is just brushed out with tremendous character actors tremendous actors that are just in a scene or two, and Mickey Rourke is in that, and he plays the father of a girl that went missing that Jack Nicholson goes to see probably 10, 15 years after she went missing. And Mickey Rourke just brings the house down in like an emotional 5-minute scene. I mean, it's like, holy fuck, man. It's like, where have you been? You know? But anyway, you've just been fucking your career up somewhere. But anyway, I mean, yeah, so that's my number five, along with The Expendables. And I think these two performances kind of go hand in hand in a way. The Expendables, I love the Expendables franchise. I think it's fantastic. I think Stallone's a genius when it comes to just doing what he does, is making just fantastical B-movies. And what was striking to me about Mickey Rourke and the Expendables is you're watching this hard R movie that's this over-the-top, one-liner, campy, purposefully campy and everything film that's just, like, ludicrous, but it's great. But you get the one scene with Mickey Rourke where he steals the movie with his emotional retelling to Stallone about that one time they were wherever they were, and he watched that woman jump off the bridge, and he could have saved her, and it was just like, holy shit. I was not expecting the emotional, maybe, you know, the emotional, almost tearjerker scene with, like, Mickey Rourke bearing it all in an Expendables movie with his Iron Man hair. I mean, with his Iron Man 2 hair, it's just, like, it's ridiculous. And his cowboy hat, and he's, like, tattooing Stallone. But, you know, I think that's one of his best performances. I mean, it's just, like, Mickey Rourke can act when he wants to act. I mean, there's no question about it. The guy's made a lot of shit. A lot of people have made a lot of shit, but not everybody has made the films Mickey Rourke has made and the performances he's had. But okay, so my number four is also a tie, because I think these two films go hand in hand, and they're also on a new Shout Factory Blu-ray that came out over the summer together.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is Michael Cimino's Desperate Hours, which was a remake of a Bogart film where Mickey Rourke just plays a fucking sociopath who takes Anthony Hopkins and Mimi Rogers hostage in their very upscale house while he's waiting for his girlfriend to come pick him up or whatever. But it's not the greatest movie ever made, but it's very good, and it's probably Cimino's last best film. The movie just gets unfairly shit upon, like Michael Cimino. But it's certainly worth a watch or a revisit if people own it. The Shout Factory Blu-ray, it comes with Desperate Hours, and along with my other tie for number four, The Pope of Greenwich Village, which is probably Mickey Rourke's seminal performance to, like, the masses. It's a very good Blu-ray. Both the film transfers are very good, and The Pope of Greenwich Village is just a very good movie. It's a small movie. I don't know how many people have seen it now, especially in our age range. But The Pope of Greenwich Pope of Greenwich Village is a very good movie with a lot of heart. Has Mickey Rourke, Daryl Hannah, and Eric Roberts in it. Eric Roberts is fantastic in that film.
It's an awesome movie.
Yeah, it's a very good low key mob movie, uh-huh. Crime movie, a youth crime movie essentially. So okay, moving on to my number three. My number three is 9 1/2 Weeks. God, that movie's awesome. That movie's awesome on so many different levels. And it's one of the most, it's probably, I don't know if it's the most sexy movie I've ever seen, but it's certainly like floating around that number one spot, probably with like a couple other movies that I can't think of at the moment. But I mean, bottom line, people who are listening to the podcast and them softly episode right now, 9 1/2 Weeks is the original Fifty Shades of Grey.
Yeah,
I haven't had or seen Fifty Shades of Grey, but I mean, 9 1/2 Weeks is the OG version of that, and it's just a great movie. It's just sexy. It's beautifully shot, beautifully acted. It's got great music in it. The Joe Cocker "You Can Leave Your Hat On" song is fantastic. That scene. But I mean, not to mention that's the movie where Kim Basinger called Mickey Rourke the human ashtray. done filming. So I mean,
yeah, they didn't like each other, huh?
No, not at all. There is that.
And it's amazing that it's so erotic and so hot, and they did not like each other.
Yeah, right. And you know what? And I think the best part about this film is it's so erotic and so sexy, but there's no gratuitous sex scenes.
Hmm.
That's what I think so great about
the movie's about it's about eroticism.
Exactly. The movie's about eroticism without being just, yeah, that's what and just everybody watch this movie. It's good.
And Adrian Lyne.
Yep.
Adrian Lyne. You know,
Mickey Rourke thanked in his acceptance speech at the Independence
and a very sensual, sexy filmmaker, a guy who's always been interested in sex and the power of sex.
But he's always pushed the envelope when he makes an erotic film. I mean, what's the guy done? He did that.
Unfaithful.
He did Unfaithful. Oh. He did Fatal Attraction. And he did the Lolita remake. And all I'll say about the Lolita remake is, I mean, everybody thinks I'm an asshole when I say this, but it's almost as good as the original movie.
Yeah, it's fantastic. The remake is fantastic.
And I'll tell you what, I mean, anybody who's a fan of Lolita or the original film or the novel is Adrian Lyne's adaptation of it with Jeremy Irons and Frank Langella, and I can't remember the girl that plays Lolita.
Dominique Swain.
Yes, that version is a more faithful adaptation to the novel.
Mm-hmm.
Even though Vladimir Nabokov wrote the adaptation for Stanley Kubrick, which I think is interesting, but that movie is great. The remake for Lolita. Anyway, okay, so my number two, I had a tough time. I have three movies left that I fit into my one and two, and I had a really hard time figuring out the placement of these. But anyway, this was a hard list to make, man. Jeez, this was tough. It was a lot harder than I thought it was going to be. But anyway, my number two is Angel Heart. Angel Heart was a movie my dad showed me on video way before I had any right to see a movie like Angel Heart. Because, I mean, that movie, like, emotionally scarred me when I was a child. But, no, seriously, that movie almost scars me now. It, like, gives me flashbacks to when I watched on VHS with my dad being like, oh, it's a Robert De Niro movie. Be like, oh, cool. But Angel Heart's nasty, man. It's just a nasty, perverse movie that's just – it still holds up today with how just grotesque it is. And Rourke gives such a raw performance in that, almost animalistic in it, is just the trashy private investigator that gets in way over his head with the case Robert De Niro puts him on. And – I mean, I don't want to give anything away because I don't know how many people have seen this movie. I think a lot of people have seen it, but if you haven't seen Angel Heart, please watch it because it's great. So then moving on to my number one is a tie between The Wrestler, which, I mean, if you don't watch The Wrestler and in the last 10 minutes of that film, if Mickey Rourke doesn't break your heart, you don't have a heart. Bottom line, I got really when, you know, the whole Oscar race between Mickey Rourke and Sean Penn had me torn because I get into the Oscar season pretty hard, even though, you know, maybe not nine times out of ten, but most of the time I disagree with who the Oscars go to. But I mean, that year you had Mickey Rourke going up against Sean Penn, and of course Sean Penn won, and Sean Penn acted the shit out of Milk. I mean, you want to talk about taking your typecast and completely shattering it. I mean, Sean Penn completely transformed himself and broke any illusion or preconceived notion you had of Sean Penn.
I agree.
And just threw it out the window. And I mean, he should have won the Oscar. But on the other hand, man, The Wrestler is the best thing Mickey Rourke has ever done and ever will do in his career. And everybody knows that. And what made that performance so special and sweet and unique is the fact that Mickey Rourke was playing a parallel of himself in The Wrestler. I mean, that's – aside from being a wrestler and everything, I mean, that's who Mickey Rourke was as a person. And he was coming back and trying to, you know, fight his way back because Mickey Rourke you know, he quit acting for a while to become a boxer. Then he got his face broke when he was boxing, and then he got plastic surgery. He doesn't really look like how he looked.
Yeah, dude,
when he was younger.
And now
he's all bulked up because he's hanging with Stallone and doing whatever. But I mean, essentially what the wrestler is somebody wanting a second chance. And I mean, Mickey Rourke, or not even wanting, I'm sorry, somebody deserving a second chance. And I mean, that's who Mickey Rourke was at that stage in his career and life. So I think the wrestler is forever going to be the best thing he's ever done or ever will do. And it's, you know, that film is fantastic on so many different levels. I mean, Aronofsky just totally floored me with that film because it was unlike anything he had ever done in his career. And that film just takes so many chances and risks that not many films would make. And it was a small indie film that just got propelled with this showboat of a performance by Mickey Rourke. So The Wrestler's awesome. The second half of my number one that I couldn't leave out is Barfly. For me personally, Charles Bukowski's my favorite writer, and I think that guy's just an absolute genius. And Barfly marks the first feature. There's not really many of them. There's Factotum with Matt Dillon that came out a couple years ago. But Charles Bukowski wrote the screenplay for Barfly, and Mickey Rourke plays Charles Bukowski's fictional-ish alter ego, Henry Chiansky. And it's just a very dilapidated and sad but yet sweet movie of a drifter who just really has no direction in life. And all he does in the movie is just get drunk with Faye Dunaway, who's, what, 15, 20 years older than him. I mean, essentially they're barflies. But it's a very poetic and raw and real performance by Rourke. And Barfly's that's hard to find. You can't really find it. I have the old Snapcase DVD that's been long out of print. I think you can probably find a cheap region 2 if you happen to be region free or have a region 2 player on DVD. That's somewhat cheap to get. But yeah, Barfly is just an incredible film on so many different levels, and it's one of those vastly unseen and underrated films of that era that I don't think too many people even know about. So if you ever get a chance to see Barfly, please do so. So my long-winded tear on Mickey Rourke probably matches your Domino.
yeah, no,
so I'm gonna turn the mic over to you.
I will say Barfly does not make my top five, but that takes nothing away from how awesome it is. That was a movie I saw well early. I probably shouldn't have been watching that movie when I first saw it. So,
right.
Yeah. And, it was,
oh, not to cut you off, but I just want to throw out an honorable mention to Sin City, which wasn't on my top five, which probably should be on people's top five for Mickey Rourke, and along with Once Upon a Time in Mexico. Even though he's not really in it that much, he's awesome. So anyway, go ahead.
But yeah, I know Barfly was the first time I'd ever seen Mickey Rourke in a movie was Barfly when I was like in the basement watching it.
Jesus, man.
Yeah, well, what year did Barfly come out?
86 or 87. Yeah. I think the first thing I saw him in was Angel Heart.
Yeah,
actually.
First thing was Barfly, because that was when I was down in my basement watching HBO when I shouldn't have been, and watching movies that my parents like would never have allowed me to watch. So Barfly was definitely the first time I'd ever seen him in a movie. And it's an awesome film. Trying to remember who directed it. Was it Barbara Schroeder?
I'll look it up right now.
But it was just a good movie, really good movie, great writing, obviously. His performance is amazing. And it's a film that I had no idea what the hell I was watching when I was a little kid.
Right, exactly.
So, then went back in later years and saw it. But my top five, I have a Michael Cimino tie at number five, but not your Cimino tie. Pulp of Greenwich Village and Year of the Dragon Those are my.
Oh, you're the dragon.
Yeah, those would be my two movies that will tie a top five. Great performances in both movies. Year of the Dragon's really intense. I love his performance in that movie. It's big. It's like kind of blustery, and he's like playing this racist Vietnam vet turned cop. And I love that movie. I think it's awesome. It's a kick-ass film. They don't make action movies like that anymore. Number four for me is Angel Heart. Once you've seen that movie, you will never forget it. It is really one of those great, underrated. It's gotten more of I think a profile in the last like maybe 10, 15 years, I would say. I think people are.
I think it's definitely like a cult film now.
It's really taken on status as a cult classic, and it's awesome. It's just juicy performances all over the place. He's great in it. Number three is Sin City. I just thought he dominated that movie just so totally and completely. He owned it.
Yep.
I still haven't seen the sequel, so I can't really comment about that. But I absolutely love the first Sin City. I thought it was just an amazingly visual experience to watch, and I just he's just perfect. I mean, his voice, his look, the mannerisms, he just fit in that world really well. So for me, that's number three. Number two is his early-ish performance in Diner.
Yeah.
Just an absolute classic movie. That cast in that film is obscene. The popcorn, the dick in the popcorn joke is arguably one of the, greatest cinematic jokes ever. put on the big screen. It will live in infamy. It's just a really funny, heartfelt movie with great performances, and he's really good in it. And it's amazing when you look at Mickey Rourke in something like Diner or Body Heat or any of these movies, 9 and a Half Weeks, because he was really, I mean, he's a good-looking guy. I mean, like when, my wife has, gotten, because through the podcast, she's been watching a lot of the movies that we've been talking about. And we've seen quite a bit of young Mickey Rourke over the last, 4 or 5 months. And, to her, he was the guy from The Wrestler, the guy with the fucked up face and, all messed up. And when she sees him younger, she just like cannot believe it. And neither can I. I mean, the man looks completely different from Year of the Dragon, in those films, which is just really totally insane. But goes without saying, for me, number one, without question, is The Wrestler. It's the soul-bearing performance. It's the pinnacle of his achievements as an actor. The movie is flawless for me. I think that it's probably Darren Aronofsky's, I don't want to say his best movie because
Right?
he's made a lot of great movies, but for
But it's
me,
his best movie.
yeah, I think it's his best movie. It's simplicity at its finest. The last shot is absolutely heartbreaking.
God.
I don't want to spoil it for people who still haven't seen it, but it's an amazing last shot. It's
All right,
overwhelming.
well, hang on. Hang on. I don't know how we're going to talk around this without like spoiling it, but how do you interpret the
Tough.
final scene?
I just
I
can't.
mean, I would assume that we interpret it the same way.
I mean, I love him too much to say. I mean, I, okay,
Right,
so
okay.
a full spoiler alert. For those of you.
Well, I mean, I guess this really isn't a spoiler because it's an ambiguous open-ended
He's a wrestler,
ending
fading.
of
The wrestler
does
is a fading heart.
does he die or not?
And,
Right.
they tell him before he goes into his last fight, the last match, you shouldn't do it. Your body can't take any more hits. And this brilliant last shot of the movie is
The
him.
close-up of his face.
It's just he scales the top rope and he jumps for his final body slam, super slam, or whatever you want to call it. And they cut to black and you don't know if he lives or dies after that final jump off the top rope.
And then the Bruce Springsteen song starts
It's
playing.
scene, and the face and the crying and the arms up, and it's just,
Ram Jam,
yeah,
his final
I
Ram
think
Jam, his signature move.
the sequence where he plays the video game with the little boy and he sees his likeness on that game, and you see the expression of like longing on his face, and the stuff with Evan Rachel Wood is touching. The dichotomy between the wrestling and the stripping on the part of Marissa Tomei, about how Marissa Tomei and about how
They
she,
have an affinity for one another
yeah,
because of what they, yeah.
exactly, and basically how they're the same person. They're using their bodies to make a career, and vice versa, and how their bodies are informing themselves as people. I think it's just a fantastic movie. The screenplay by Robert Siegel was just really brilliant. I mean, it really was. You know, and I'm going to throw this out there real quick because I mentioned Robert Siegel. Did you ever see a film called Big Fan? With Patton Oswalt.
With Patton Oswalt? No, I have not.
Definitely watch it. It's a pisser.
All right.
It's a great dark comedy. It's written by Siegel, the same guy who wrote The Wrestler.
Okay.
I believe he directed it as well. I think it came out a year after The Wrestler. He got it made because of the success of The Wrestler. It's a really funny movie with a great, great ending. But back to The Wrestler, the best performance he'll ever give.
A movie, it's just so good.
One of those movies where you see the inside of someone and you see the performance of a lifetime for somebody right before your eyes.
It's that film, man. I know you and I get chastised online when we throw Masterpiece around. There's a lot of people that jump on our ass whenever we start calling movies masterpieces.
Whatever.
Because, I mean, that word's so overused, and I get it. But, I mean, you and I see a lot of movies, and we do see a lot of masterpieces. But, I mean, The Wrestler is a fucking masterpiece, man.
I agree. I completely agree.
Oh, it's a masterpiece. It's like,
yeah, they can – when you have a film scene for scene you can't find fault with, when you have a movie that you don't want to end – when you have a movie where you want...
Where it affects you,
yeah, where it
as
affects
hard
you.
As
yeah.
The ending of... Like, The Wrestler made me cry in theaters.
Me too. It was my number... I had it as my number one film for that year.
So, I know... I just want to throw a quick plug, because neither one of us and I mentioned Killshot, which I think is a very good film that flew under the radar, because I think it got a straight-to-DVD distribution for whatever reason. But... Mickey Rourke is fantastic in Killshot as the Native American hitman that takes Joseph Gordon-Levitt under his wing. I didn't mean to cut you off, but I just want to throw Killshot in because I think Killshot, he's fantastic. And I think the movie's good, but he's so much better than the film.
Mm-hmm.
I also want to throw out his role in Animal Factory that Steve Buscemi directed off of Edward Bunker. Novel is good, and he's good in Get Carter, even though that movie sucks, but it doesn't suck, it's just you know,
yeah,
it is what it is, and it's just like
it's a remake of Get Carter.
if they just would have made that a different film and not called it Get Carter, I think
exactly.
It would have done better.
Exactly.
but yeah, he's awesome. So yeah, I mean, man, I love Mickey Rourke. It's just a shame, you know, you look on Mickey Rourke's IMDb now. And it's just straight to VOD action films, and it's like, dude, why aren't you in Expendables 2 and 3? And but whatever, I mean, shit happens, and you marry some hot Russian chick and go live in Russia for a while. So I mean, I can't really blame the guy. I mean, whatever.
Totally. Well, yeah, I know it's definitely been fun getting back to an old show.
Back to an old show.
Yeah, I mean, we've had so many amazing, and we wanted to – I'll just say, and I'm sure I'm thanking for you too. Thank you to all of our guests that have come on our program and have talked to us and taken time out of their busy schedules to listen to two ranting and raving movie, you know, freaks, tell them how awesome they are. So we really do appreciate everybody doing that. And for people who out there who are enjoying this podcast and listening with any regularity, we definitely have some really cool stuff coming up over the next little bit. So,
yeah. And thanks to everybody who's listened and supported us and everything. And, yeah, it's been wild. It's still surreal and crazy and everything. And I just wanted to say that, we are going to do another regularly, or I shouldn't say scheduled, another regular podcast next week because Nick, this Sunday, is going to see Roger Waters' The Wall in a high frame rate in 3D on IMAX at some theater near him, and Nick's face is going to melt faster and hotter than the three Nazis' face melts in Raiders of the Lost Ark when he sees this spectacle in front of him because he has no idea yeah. how to prepare for it or what he's going to see. So anyway, next week, Nick and I are going to do a regular podcast on Roger Waters' The Wall, and we're going to discuss it because it's one of, I think, it's one of the best films of the year, and it's truly this unique and special film that got made, and it's coming out on Blu-ray the first of December. So if you guys didn't get a chance to see it in theaters either one of the times it was playing, you'll be able to pick it up on home video. So highly recommended. I can't even wait for you to see it and tell me what you think, and I can't even wait to discuss it. So
yeah,
stay tuned for that.
I'm really looking forward. Big fan of Pink Floyd in general, and love Alan Parker's The Wall, and love listen to the music forever. So I've never seen Roger Waters in concert. I know you have twice.
I have like seven times. I saw The Wall twice.
So I'm very anxious to see it. I can't wait. We'll definitely get into that. And just want to throw one quick shout out to a friendly shout out to another podcast, because I have a feeling that I'm going to be paying attention to their work, because I love under the radar movies and gems. I just want to throw a shout out to Never Heard of It. People should check this podcast out. It's run by Sean Harwell and Craig Moorhead, two writers in the industry. And their whole goal is to pick a movie that people ostensibly have never heard of and to do, a show on a very under the radar title. And just going through their early episodes, it's been very fun to listen to their podcast. And I recommend people check it out, especially if you're looking for those, weird, crazy titles that you've never heard of, like Robert De Niro and The Swap. So for anybody out there looking for another good podcast, check them out. Never Heard of It.
Yeah, I don't have a podcast to plug, guys. So I hope you continue to listen to ours.
Yes, and of course, obviously. But
okay.
Throw a bone out to relative newbie show. So
I'm gonna edit the last part of this podcast out. So
what?
It was a joke. I'm joking. It was a joke to end the podcast. But So we're good. All right, guys. We'll catch you soon.
Yes, looking forward to doing more of our regular episodes for sure. It's always fun.
See you guys. Thanks for listening to our podcast.